So our reading is from the book of Jonah, which can be found on page 774, at chapter 1, verse 1. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me." But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord. But the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship threatened to break up. Then the mariners were afraid, and each cried out to his God. And they hurled the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. But Jonah had gone down into the inner part of the ship and had lain down and was fast asleep. So the captain came and said to him, "What do you mean, you sleeper? Arise, call out to your God. Perhaps the God will give us will give a thought to us that we may not perish." And they said to one another, "Come, let us cast lots, that we may know on whose account this evil has come upon us." So they cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. Then they said to him, "Tell us, on whose account this evil has come upon us? What is your occupation, and where do you come from? What is your country, and of what people are you?" And he said to them, "I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, "What is this that you have done?" For the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord because he had told them. Then they said to him, "What shall we do to you that the sea may quiet down for us?" For the sea grew more and more tempestuous. He said to them, "Pick me up and hurl me into the sea. Then the sea will quiet down for you. For I know it is because of me that this great tempest has come upon you." Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to get back to dry land, but they could not, for the sea grew more and more tempestuous against them. Therefore they called out to the Lord, "O Lord, let us not perish for this man's life, and lay not on us innocent blood. For you, O Lord, have done as it pleased you." So they picked up Jonah and hurled him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows.
Thanks very much, Sam. And let me add my welcome to Kenneth. It's great to see you this evening. There's a handout in the middle of your service sheet, and with the help of that, you can follow where we're going tonight. And also, do please keep that passage open in front of you. We'll be referring to it as we go. Well, I've got soon an end-of-year review coming up. I'm on the staff here at Euston, and my end-of-year review is going to be with Kev. And I don't know about you, but I'm not a great fan of end-of-year reviews. It's nothing about Kev, it's just that I don't particularly like thinking about all my mistakes and my failures over the past year. Now hopefully it's not all going to be bad, is it?
I've got my clipboard.
Oh dear. But all the same, even thinking at all about my mistakes, it's not pleasant. Of course it's fine, isn't it, in an end of year review if you've managed to blag your way into everybody's good books, into everybody thinking that you're perfect. My wife did that at her first end of year review at her current firm. They said to her, "Nothing to improve." And that's remarkable, partly because it's completely wrong. She's an accountant, can barely count to 10 without the aid of a calculator. And of course it doesn't help when people say that to you anyway, because you know that there's always stuff to improve, and you live in fear wondering how long it'll be till someone else makes that earth-shattering discovery. But even if you're confident about your end of year reviews at work, or maybe the grades that you're about to get published for your exams, if you're students, I wonder how you'd feel about an end of year review for your witness to God's word in this world. Now don't worry, Kev isn't going to be calling all of you into his office, though who knows, maybe that would help. But of course it's not actually Kev who's our boss ultimately when it comes to the work of witnessing. It's God who's our boss. He's the one who commissions us into his mission. He calls all Christians to be his prophets in the New Testament. We're going to see that in our series in September in Acts. And what is a prophet? Well, I think verse 1 helps, doesn't it? Take a look at it with me. A prophet is someone to whom the word of the Lord has come, someone who's then charged with telling that word to others. And we are called to explain the gospel word that has come to us if we're Christians. We're called to explain it to this evil world so that people would come to their senses and turn back to God for mercy. And that prophetic calling is a high calling, a calling for every Christian. So how are you doing at it? How's your witness in the world? Now, I suspect that might be a pretty depressing and possibly even guilt-inducing question for some of us. I know it can be for me. And the work of spreading the gospel, of course, is my only job. For some of you, you've got degrees to study for and actual jobs like Jane, teaching, let alone getting on with the work of witness. But even so, I'm still a pretty hopeless witness. A witless witness. I know I ought to be bolder, more dedicated, more compassionate to the people who are facing an eternity without hope. And if you, like me, think that you can be a rubbish witness in this world, then Jonah's story is just the story for you. You see, Jonah was a complete mess. I think he's got to be up there, or down there rather, amongst the worst prophets in the whole of the Old Testament. He was a disobedient hypocrite. He took God's mercy to him for granted, whilst hating God's mercy to others. And frankly, we'll see him behave like a spoilt brat as we go on in Jonah. He's a complete mess, a really bad prophet. But a bad prophet that God uses over the course of this book to bring about a great salvation. And more than that, a bad prophet that over the course of this book, God aims to make better. You see, God wanted to help Jonah change. Jonah's a small book, but it punches above its weight because it gets to the heart of why and how we fail as God's witnesses in this world. And it helps us change. Now, if you're not a Christian here, and you're thinking, what on earth has this got to do with me? Well, I hope at the very least you'll get some insight into why Christians are so annoyingly keen to share what they believe with other people all the time. And perhaps you'll be encouraged to listen just a little bit more, to take it a bit more seriously. Well, anyway, let's begin with our first point today. Jonah doesn't believe what he says about God. That's his first big problem in the book, in chapter 1. He doesn't really believe what he says. I wonder, did you notice at the heart of today's passage, there's a kind of statement of Jewish doctrine, a summary of what Jews believed. It's something that all God-fearing Jews would have recognised as sound as a pound, orthodox, kosher. It's there in verse 9. Take a look at it with me. Verse 9, he said to them, I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. Now, you can't get more orthodox than this. It's actually not a bad statement of the whole Jewish faith in some ways. Here's a man who knows that his God is the true God above all other gods, because he's the maker of everything. And he also talks about a right response to this God. Did you see it? I fear the Lord. He knows his maker deserves to be feared. I am a Hebrew and I fear the Lord. But do you? Do you really, Jonah? Then how come when God says in verse 2, arise and go to Nineveh, you in verse 3 go to Tarshish? It's repeated 3 times, just so we get the point. God says Nineveh, Jonah's actions say Tarshish, Tarshish, Tarshish. You know, Tarshish is a place that, well, was a place that is now modern-day Spain. So I don't know how good your geography of the Mediterranean is. I guess it might be slightly better at this time of the year as we plan holidays. But Tarshish, modern-day Spain, it's about 5,000 kilometres to the west. Is that right? I always get my geography wrong. Yes, to the west of Israel, across the Med. But Nineveh was in what is now modern-day Iraq, to the east, 1,000 kilometres to the northeast of Israel. So it's like God is saying, go east, and Jonah heads west. And if you're tempted to have some sympathy for Jonah, because let's face it, Nineveh in verse 1, or verse 2 rather, sounds like a pretty horrible place, doesn't it? Their evil has come up before me, says God. So if you're tempted to have some sympathy for him, well, don't be deceived. You see, Spain was not a tourist destination in Jonah's day, but the edge of the known world, right on the edge of the map. A hostile place, a wild place, no better than Nineveh. No, Jonah is simply disobeying, for reasons that we shall discover in chapter 4. Now, the author underlines how direct this disobedience is with his word choices. So, verse 2, God says, arise, go, get up and get going. And in verse 3, Jonah did rise, Jonah rose, but then things start to go downhill. Did you notice as he goes down and down and down? So verse 3, he goes down to Joppa, and then he goes down into the boat after he's paid the fare. And then verse 5, Jonah had gone down, middle of the verse, Jonah had gone down into the inner part of the ship. And then he had lain down, and then finally got down to some sleep. And of course, sleeping is the very opposite in some ways of getting up, arising. It's a play on words. The arise word is what you do in the morning when you've woken up. Arise! But instead, Jonah goes to sleep. You see, Jonah's words are orthodox, but his actions are heterodox. And for those of you that aren't geeks like me, that means he says what is right, but he does what is wrong. He doesn't really fear God at all. Imagine in my end of year review with Kev, I claim that I've really grown in my respect of him as my boss this year. I've just carried on doing the direct opposite of everything he asks me to do. He says, preach on Leviticus, I turn up and preach on Jonah. He says, speak for 40 minutes, I decide to speak for 30. Now, I'd just like to say, after I've spoken on Jonah for 30 minutes, that is actually what he asked me to do this evening, don't worry. But do you get the point? This is sheer hypocrisy, to say that he fears God. Now, God wants us to sit down with him this evening and to review our obedience to his great commission to go and preach the gospel. And let me say that even if our words tell the wonderful story of God and the right response of worship, what God really wants to review with us this evening is our actions. You see, Jonah's actions tell a grubby tale of disobedience, don't they? And worse than that, it is foolish disobedience. He's such a muppet. How can you claim to fear the God who made the sea and all the land, and then try and flee from that God over the sea that God made to a land that God made? It's ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense. He's a fool. Again, Jonah's words are right here. God is the maker of the whole earth, land and sea, and that's why, of course, God feels that he's within his rights to send his Jewish prophet to the Assyrian town of Nineveh, even though the Assyrians worshipped very different gods to the Jews. It doesn't matter who the nations worship. As the only true maker of all, God is also the judge of all, the one whose judgment is for all the earth, because he made all the earth. So then, what is Jonah playing at? Has he lost his mind, thinking that he can escape God's justice by fleeing to another part of the earth that God made? It doesn't make sense. You know, wherever people try to flee from God, ultimately they'll find that God's justice just got there first. It was always there. You can't flee from the presence of the Lord because he made the whole earth and his presence fills the earth. And of course, that's exactly what the storm here is a mini foretaste of, that day of judgment when the judge of all the earth will call all men and women to account. Trying to escape from the maker of the sea across a sea that the maker made, Jonah is just running straight into the arms of the judge. There's a sort of farcical and grim inevitability about it, isn't there? It's ridiculous. Well, I wonder, are you ever tempted to disobey God? Jesus, you might know if you're a Christian and have read Mark's Gospel, for example, you might know that Jesus commands us Christians to live and die for his sake and for the gospel's sake. And we say Jesus is our king. But do we believe it? You know, it's fascinating. Jonah chapter 1 here is so like the storm on the Sea of Galilee in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 4, for those of you that happen to know it. I wonder, do you remember it? There's a storm. The disciples are perishing. Jesus is asleep. They wake him up, and he wakes up, and he doesn't need to call out to God. He just rebukes the wind and the waves. And there's total calm. And the disciples are afraid of Jesus, asking, who is this that the wind and the seas obey him? And who is Jesus? Well, isn't it obvious? He's the God of Jonah in this passage, who has total control over the sea because he made it. So the question for us is, as Christians, do we fear Jesus, the God of heaven, the maker of the land and the sea? And we might say we do, but what do our actions say? Do we live for him? Do we die for him daily, dying to ourselves and our own agendas to live instead for his sake and for the gospel's sake? That's what he commands us to do. Or are we ever tempted to pretend that, well, God's presence hasn't really reached our office, our lecture room, our bedroom, that his sovereign rule hasn't really extended to our floor of the building, our corner of London, as though if we just get our head down and motor on with work, then God won't notice. You know, like the little toddler who naively shuts his eyes to all the people around him. I can't see you, so you can't see me. But of course, God can see. He's everywhere, the maker of all. Do we recognise that one day we will all give account to him for our actions on this earth? Have our beliefs about Christ filtered down to our hearts so that they affect our actions? Or have they got stuck on our lips? Take some time this week, please, to think about your actions. And if they don't say much about fearing and obeying Jesus, then what you need to work on, like me, like all of us, no doubt, is your belief. Do you really believe what you say you do? Well, let's move on to a couple of implications of all this. Firstly, we are to get on with fearing the God that we say we fear. So that's our next point on the sheet. I wonder if you ever get that feeling, though, that try as you might, nothing can ever really change. Now, one of the dangers of looking at a hopeless case like Jonah is that it just reinforces that sense of hopelessness. You know, we're going to get to chapter 4 in a few weeks, and we're going to see that actually not a huge amount has changed in him. So is it hopeless? If this guy can't get it right, then what hope do we have? Well, I love in moments like that to look at people who do get it right. People who give me an inspirational example. And one of the people who's most inspired me to keep going over the years is a girl that I met many years ago when I was a student on a year abroad working in Minsk in Belarus. I'd gone out to Minsk to be an adjunct missionary, which is a very grand sounding title, isn't it? An adjunct missionary of the International Federation of Evangelical Students. I was coming from a great church back home. I'd been taught loads of great truth. I knew loads of sound as a pound doctrine. And I thought I was going out there to teach people. But in Belarus, I met a girl called Liana. She was a goth at university, covered from head to toe in tattoos, liked some kind of metal. Apparently that's kind of music. I think it was death metal. Death metal, is that right? Makes you deaf or something? I don't know. And she'd recently been converted just before I got there. Nothing to do with me, obviously. And then I watched as, within the first year of her being a Christian, she sat down all her family and every course mate who would listen and gently but urgently tried to explain the gospel to them. And she did that because she got it. She really believed. And two of her friends and her mum became Christians that year. I thought I was going to teach people like her. And I guess in some ways I did teach her a lot of truth. But she taught me a lot about belief, about consistency between what we say and what we do. She didn't have all the advantages I'd had in terms of church, discipleship, teaching, but what little she knew, she really believed. And I find that kind of belief inspirational because it says to me, it is possible to get it right. We don't have to be hopeless cases. And of course, for all Jonah's failures in this passage, there are some people here who really get it, who get the fear of God. And they were unlikely believers, at least in Jonah's eyes, if not in God's. They were recent converts, in fact. They were converted, in fact, in this very chapter. And it is, of course, the pagan sailors that I'm talking about. These sailors, look at them. They don't have the knowledge, the learning that Jonah has had, but they get the fear of God. And they say to us, it is possible to fear God rightly. Look at how their fear evolves throughout this passage. Did you see what they fear in verse 5? Verse 5, the mariners were afraid. They're afraid of the storm there, of course. Then in verse 10, having previously heard that Jonah's fleeing from the Lord, having seen the storm, and having just now heard that the Lord is the maker of the sea, they put, well, 3 and 3 together in this instance, and make 6. They work out that it's really worth being afraid of this God. They're exceedingly afraid. And then by verse 16, look at verse 16. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly. They fear God. They come to fear him in a personal way. And actually, in verse 16 here, they worship God a lot like Old Testament Jews would have done. Offering sacrifices, making vows. That's the kind of thing you can hear in the Psalms that we've been reading tonight that Jewish people were supposed to do as they recognized who this God really is. You know, again here, it's really striking. If you go back to the description of the storm on the Sea of Galilee in the Gospel of Mark in chapter 4, then when the storm kicks off, we see the disciples are afraid of perishing. They're afraid of the storm. But when they see Jesus' power as he calms the winds and the waves, they're exceedingly afraid of him. Which is just to say that it's not Jonah who foreshadows true disciples of Christ here. But these pagan sailors foreshadow true disciples. Isn't that interesting? It's really ironic. Because Jonah's the Jewish one. And the passage is full of ironies as we compare the sailors' fear with Jonah's. So, for instance, the Gentiles teach Jonah the job of mission. Did you see that? So what did God call him to do in verse 2? He called him to arise, go, and call out against the city of Nineveh. And then look at verse 6. Well after the storm has kicked off, the captain comes to Jonah and commands him to arise, call out. Now, of course, I know that in verse 2, God was saying, call out to Nineveh, and here the captain's saying, call out to God. But isn't it striking that the author has mirrored God's words in the captain's mouth? It's supposed to be ironic. And, of course, the double job of calling out to other people as we call out to God for mercy is the work of mission, isn't it? And then again, the sailors teach Jonah about prayer. They turn to their pagan gods in fear and cry out for help. And again, notice in verse 6 that the captain is astonished that Jonah isn't praying. What are you playing at, you sleeper? Arise, call out to your God. And of course, the greatest irony here is that Jonah's God is the only God that can actually save. He should have been the one telling them to pray, teaching them to pray to the true maker of heaven and earth. But they have to teach him. And then finally, the sailors teach Jonah all about compassion for the lost. Compassion for the lost. They teach him to work hard for others' salvation, to put his back into others' salvation. So in verse 12, he says, the only way to calm the storm is to throw me in. But did you notice they're unwilling to let him die, even though they're putting themselves in the way of danger? So verse 13, the very first thing they do after they've heard this is row hard to get back to dry land. Isn't that remarkable? And remember here, the boat has been breaking up since verse 4. So by this stage, the wind would have been howling, the storm's been getting worse and worse, the rain would have been lashing their face, bits of the boat would have been sinking into the sea, it would have been breaking up far worse than before. And yet they're still unwilling to throw this guy in the sea to save their own necks. Isn't that remarkable? They have compassion on him. They risk their own lives to get him to the safety of harbour. And why do they act like this? Well, because they fear God. Did you see that in verse 14? Let's read verse 14. It's remarkable. So remember, the storm is still going on at this stage. But before they throw Jonah in, they find time, nevertheless, to pray to God. With the storm still going on, they say, "Oh Lord, let us not perish for this man's life. Lay not on us innocent blood, for you, O Lord, have done as it pleased you." And only then do they pick up Jonah. You see, their thinking is, if they have it in their power to save a man, they'd be guilty of his blood before God if they didn't do all that they can. And they're only prepared to give up once they've done what they can. Then and only then will they leave this man in the hands of God with fear and trembling. They're afraid of being called to account before God for how they've treated other people's lives. And you know, the sailors here, they weren't educated in Israel. They hadn't had years of reading the Old Testament and meditating on its lessons about the love of God and the love of man. They hadn't done word studies on grace or self-sacrifice or mercy or compassion. Their doctrine of God had been formed in the course of, I guess, less than a few hours in a storm. But they know what to do spontaneously. They get it because they believe the little that they know. I mean, they even quote our theme verse for this evening in that prayer in verse 14. Having never read it, obviously, it just comes spontaneously to their lips. You, O Lord, have done what you pleased. Isn't that remarkable? Well, I wonder, do you find all of this exposing if you're a Christian here tonight? Are you praying for others' salvation because you fear God and you care for people? Are you putting your back into witnessing because you fear God and you care about people? I find this horribly exposing, but again, we should find it also inspirational. If these pagan sailors can get it right, then so can we. But we just need to get on with believing what we say we believe about God. And again, look, I know there are some big differences between saving people through the gospel and saving people from drowning. But can't we let the heroism of these sailors inspire us? Or perhaps just take the heroism of some of the people we've seen recently in the terror attacks. Did you read this week? I know Ed Yates will have done, because he, like me, as we've mentioned many times, is a religious reader of everything on the BBC News website. Did you read this week on the BBC News website about the policeman who single-handedly tackled three of the attackers on London Bridge with just a baton? Wasn't that remarkable? And do you know what his explanation for it was when they said, "Why did you do that?" He said, "I was just doing my job." I just wanted to save as many people as possible. Isn't that remarkable? And again, I know that saving people from terrorists in some ways is going to get you lots of plaudits. People are going to think of you as a hero, whereas people hate it when we try to tell them the gospel a lot of the time because they're ignorant of their real need. But that's our job. That's the point of telling them the gospel, to show them what their real need is, so that they'll turn back to God. And even if we're never recognised as heroes in this world, even if we're never interviewed by the BBC, isn't it just our job to save as many people as we can? That's what Paul says, the apostle. I do all that I can to save as many as I can. And ultimately, shouldn't we just do it because we fear God and we know we're going to be called to account for how we treated other people's lives? Well, finally, I just want to say a final point. Aim to believe what you say, but don't give up when you fail. There are a couple of examples from the New Testament who, when it comes to mission, they actually did what they said they believed. They're people who talk the talk and walk the walk. They are, of course, Paul and Jesus. And they show us how not to be an unprofitable prophet like Jonah. So Paul, for example. Remarkably, Paul, like Jonah, also wanted to go to Spain. But he didn't want to go there to get away from God and God's mission. No, he wanted to go to what was still the kind of farthest corner of the world in his day. He wanted to go there to give his life to making the gospel known, to make God's word known. It's funny, isn't it, how easy it is to travel around the continent, around Europe. I guess lots of us Brits will have done it. Lots of you who come from abroad will be glad you're in London because of all the opportunities to travel around Europe. I'm doing Europe this summer. That's what I've heard a lot. And that's great. It's wonderful. But do you know more about Europe as a holiday destination than you do about the needs for the gospel there? Shouldn't we let God's mission, our calling to be prophets, shape how we view Europe and indeed the whole world? Paul did. And then finally, Jesus. Jesus, the prophet who obeyed God. He obeyed his Father by coming down to the earth. He obeyed by willingly taking upon himself the storm of God's anger at the cross. He sailed into the arms of God's storm of judgment. Not because he was an ignorant fool like Jonah, but he did it with his eyes open because he had compassion on us and wanted to take the storm of that judgment that should fall on us on himself. And you know what? He calls us to follow in his footsteps, to be like him, to take up our cross daily for the sake of others, for his sake and for the gospel's. It's remarkable, isn't it? And I'd love to draw out these contrasts to Jonah to tell us to be better, to say change, to say that inconsistency between our actions and our message is deadly for the message, and indeed it can be. Now, maybe you're not a Christian here today, and you've many tales of Christian hypocrisy that have put you off listening to the message of Christianity. So on behalf of all the other hypocrites, myself included here tonight, I'd just like to say, don't let us put you off listening to Jesus. He's not a hypocrite. And actually, the biggest hypocrisy that I'd like to apologise for tonight is that we don't try harder to tell you God's word, because that's the best thing we can do for you. I'm sorry that we don't do it more. And for those of you who, like me, feel that you are hypocrites on this point, let me encourage you with this very final thought. God still uses failures to save people. I mean, look at the net result of Jonah's disobedience. This detour, as it becomes, from going to Nineveh, God uses it to save a whole crew of pagan sailors. We might want to be the best witnesses we can, but even as we fail, God can still use us to save everybody he wants. And that should make us not give up, but press on in the work of mission.